This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we will hear an update on the case of Rachel Corey, who was crushed to death by a caterpillar D9R bulldozer while trying to protect the home of a Palestinian doctor.
Finally, a trial of her case is going ahead in Haifa, Israel. Let's see if the Israelis can give any measure of justice to Rachel Corey and her family.
We'll hear about a side of President John F. Kennedy that few knew about.
That he was taking steps to end the Cold War, get out of Vietnam, had back channels with Khrushchev and Castro, and that's why he was killed. All this is in James W. Douglas's book, JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters.
Stay with us.
Heidi, every year we go back to look again at the Armenian Genocide, and we do that because every year there's a proposal in Congress, a resolution to try and label what happened in 1915 in Turkey, Armenia, as a genocide. Again, it happened this year, and why don't you bring us up to date about what's going on in Congress about labeling what happened in 1915 as genocide?
Well, Michael, you're correct that this does seem to come up every year. Each April 24th, Armenians worldwide observe a Remembrance Day for the 1.5 million Armenians who were killed. And I should note that Muslim Turkey acknowledges that these Christian Armenians were killed by Ottoman forces. What they deny, however, is that it amounted to genocide. And that has been a term employed by Western historians as well as many foreign parliaments.
The reason that it's controversial, of course, it's one thing to be killed in a war, in an insurgency, etc. It's another thing to be killed because of your nationality, your ethnicity, your religion, or your race. And
the intent
to actually wipe out people of those four categories.
Exactly. And that's what the Turkish government is saying, that there was no intent. The glimmer of good news was that by a 23-22 vote 2 weeks ago, the House Foreign Relations Committee approved a bill recognizing that the Ottomans, in fact, committed genocide. And then, as has happened before, the Turkish ambassador was recalled in protest.
Right. The Turkey recalled their U.S. ambassador, right?
Yes. And they're saying they won't send him back into Washington until they have assurances that this bill is not going to become law. And actually, it doesn't really have clout. It's mostly symbolic. But a couple of weeks ago, Hillary Clinton started pressuring members of the committee not to vote for it. And it seems pretty clear that although Obama repeatedly pledged to recognize the Armenian genocide when he was campaigning, he has since refrained from using that word, implicitly citing the need not to undermine Turkish-Armenian relations and also our big stake in Turkey politically. And it's interesting because the chief executives of Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Raytheon, and other large corporations issued a rare joint letter a few weeks ago warning that passage of this measure could lead, quote, to a rupture in U.S.-Turkey relations and put American jobs at risk. That deals, of course, with our defense and aerospace exports to Turkey, which exceeded $7 billion in 2009.
So if we have any doubts that human rights genocides are hostage to politics and, of course, as you're now saying, to business, this should put that to rest. Because here's something that most of the world, I think, would agree was a case of genocide, which is going after people with the intent to murder them because of their ethnicity or their nationality.
I think that's right. And the week before the vote, 60 Minutes actually aired a segment on it, and it started with walking on a hill where the bones of thousands of people were right there on the surface, and they said that children were playing with them, just dumped on a hill.
And one reason here at Law and Disorder we're so conscious of this, of course, is because our own Heidi Boghossian is the granddaughter of a woman who lost much of her family during the genocide and herself was subjected to very, very severe repression because of the genocide.
Right. Well, at least even if this continues to happen, Michael, year after year, at least we hope that it raises the consciousness of certain people who haven't heard about this.
What is the status of Armenians now in Turkey? I mean, are they Do you know much about that? Are they?
A lot of them are actually no longer Christians, but are rather Muslims. But I don't know specifically about the relationship sort of status-wise, which had been a big issue years ago.
Right. If they speak out on this issue, I know that there's tremendous repression.
Exactly. And also, as you know, no one in Turkey can mention the word genocide
in reference to this.
Well, it's a crime.
Wow.
Yeah.
So there you go. So maybe next year, but we hope. But as long as Boeing's doing business with Turkey, I'm not sure.
Michael, we haven't talked for a while in Guantanamo and the current lawyers in the administration and what's happening with the terrorism trials and how that will affect Guantanamo. What's happening?
There's a lot going on. As usual, the right, conservative right in particular, is pushing heavily to show that President Obama is extremely weak on national security. Their most recent tactic was to say that there were 9 lawyers, what they call the Al-Qaeda 9, who at one time or another either represented people at Guantanamo or had some role in representing people at Guantanamo or lobbying in some way, saying that those people are working as sort of essentially fifth column inside the administration, and they're called the Al-Qaeda 9, and saying to Attorney General Holder, give us those names, give us those names. Sounds like McCarthyite a tactic. I mean, I have a list of names of 9 Al-Qaeda lawyers who are working for the administration. And of course, the attack is completely absurd. In their lives, many lawyers represent many different people. It doesn't mean they share their ideology with them. And in this case, of course, didn't mean that, but it meant that they were fighting for very unpopular clients, for very fundamental rights. Now, what's interesting is that attack was then taken on by many conservative lawyers. When I say taken on, a number of conservative lawyers said this is not a good attack. This is a wrong attack. Lawyers in this country are supposed to represent unpopular causes, and we ourselves don't like what Liz Cheney, really, most likely at the behest of Papa Cheney and some others, are doing to attack Holder and the Obama administration on this. So there has been a fair amount of resistance to this kind of attack. At the same time, this kind of attack does weaken Obama and pushes him more and more away from carrying out constitutional rights or essentially strengthening constitutional rights at Guantanamo and other places, because he doesn't want to be perceived as weak on national security. So it really knocks him around some more, and he hasn't been strong on this to begin with. So even though these lawyers are not going to lose their jobs, it's still a serious issue.
I think it was heartening that these lawyers recently came forward, and it includes members of the very conservative Federalist Society, who even acknowledged that this case, this argument would bolster sort of the Republican Party's agenda. However, it's just contrary to our form of a democratic legal system where everyone has the right to a fair trial.
Right. As I recall, it even had as one of the lawyers who said this is not a fair tactic was Cully Stimson, who was the head of detainee affairs in the Pentagon under George Bush, who originally himself went after the lawyers, saying that businesses should stop doing business with these law firms because they're representing Guantanamo detainees. He then lost his job because of that, made an apology because of that, a serious apology, and now he is actually saying that this attack on the lawyers in the administration is unfair.
Let's take it a step further, Michael. Given the recent Humanitarian Law Project argument before the Supreme Court that David Cole on behalf of the Center for Constitutional Rights argued, and the rather stunning comment that the Solicitor General made that writing an amicus brief, a lawyer asked to write an amicus brief, could be considered material support. In the case of this current calling out of the lawyers representing Guantanamo inmates, in an extreme example, could this be considered material support or aid to terrorism?
Boy, it's a pretty interesting question, Heidi. I mean, the fact that Solicitor General of the United States, in arguing the case about material aid, actually said that if you file an amicus brief on behalf of an organization that we, the U.S. government, have designated as terrorist, that might be would be materially aiding that organization, means in some way the only reason that lawyers aren't maybe getting prosecuted right now is because they're deciding not to, but that they have the weapons to do it. So that is an important point you're making, that when lawyers aren't allowed to defend an organization, whether directly, which they're not yet saying, or through an amicus brief, which they are saying, you're talking about a serious, you're really putting fundamental rights in serious jeopardy.
at the least, it has what we call a chilling effect. It may intimidate lawyers from bringing this kind of case.
I think that's right. What it means is that lawyers are going to say, do I want to get attacked next week in the newspapers? Do I want hanging over my head that I might be materially aiding terrorism? This is all part of really what I call the utter debasement of the law in this country, from Guantanamo to torture to the material aid statute, and the fact that we're no longer living, certainly in the national security area, under the rule of law.
Michael, we've seen in the news almost every day about the moving the terrorist, so-called terrorist trial from New York City. Is it going to be a civilian trial or a military trial? What's happening?
Now, Heidi, this is an issue that you and I and Law and Disorder have been talking about for years now. And I remember how shocked I was when the Bush administration first put in military commissions, which are not courts-martials, and they're obviously not civil criminal trials. There's something made up after the fact. Military commissions, they make up the rules after the person has already been arrested. So I've never liked them. They're illegal. They're illegal under the Geneva Conventions. You can't make up the rules after the fact. They have a very limited use, which is when you're on the battlefield and there's no chance to do anything else. Then there's a limited exception for using a military commission for very quick summary justice. And so you had hoped when Obama took office that it would end. And on this issue, he suspended all the military commissions for 4 months. There's only been three, actually, that have happened in 8 years. There's been 300 criminal trials, so-called terrorists. There's been only three of these military commissions. So what happens? They decide they're going to try the so-called five 9/11 alleged terrorists in Manhattan. Then, of course, they get cold feet and they say, okay, we'll move it out of Manhattan, but we'll still have a criminal trial. And then, as we watch week by week, they keep backing off from that. So now the last statement is, well, we're not so sure it's going to be a federal criminal trial. Now we're thinking of a military commission again. And, of course, who do they say is behind it? They say it's all politics and Rahm Emanuel is behind it. He's pushing for military commissions because as a political matter, he's trying to figure out how to negotiate and make Obama look strong on military matters as well as terrorism matters. So they're backing off. They ought to just call this just breaking promises, going back to the Bush policies, and that's what Obama is doing. Now, the articles have blamed Rahm Emanuel, the chief of staff, for making political decisions rather than legal and essentially overriding Holder on these issues. But, you know, I blame Holder as well. He's not been strong on these issues. And the problem is, once you go down the road in saying there's choices for how to prosecute people, whether you do them in federal criminal trials or military commissions or preventive detention, once you give those choices to a prosecutor, to Holder or others, they're going to, as quickly as they can, go to the lowest common denominator and the one that pleases people's cries for blood, that pleases. I remember debating Cheney a long time ago when he said terrorists don't have any constitutional rights. And I just said, well, how do you know they're terrorists until you try them with constitutional rights? But that's what's happening. So as you've allowed choices in how you prosecute people, you're seeing lowest common denominator, and it allows it to be played to the political audience and the political crowd.
Now, one of the arguments for moving it out of New York was the cost to the city that this would have had in the length of the trial. In a nutshell, do you think a military trial, can the government argue it would be more cost effective? Is it shorter?
Well, it's cheap in the short run, rather. It's cheaper. You go to some military base that you and I can't even walk onto, and you put the trial in some so-called secure place in the middle of that military base, and no one knows about it. It's essentially you put a television crew, you know, next door on a feed, and probably that's the ballgame. So, yeah, it's not a fair kind of trial.
This month, the Haifa District Court in Israel will begin hearing eyewitness testimonies in a civil lawsuit filed in 2005 by Rachel Corrie's family against the State of Israel for her unlawful killing in Rafah, Gaza. On March 16, 2003, Rachel was crushed to death by a Caterpillar D9R bulldozer while trying to protect the home of a Palestinian doctor from demolition. She was run over and killed by an IDF soldier who was operating the bulldozer. 7 years later, Rachel's parents are still seeking the truth. The trial is expected to show the circumstances of her death and hold the Israeli military responsible. Four eyewitnesses to Rachel's killing have been recently granted visas by Israel to testify, but Israel is refusing to allow the Palestinian doctor who treated Rachel and confirmed her death. Updates on the case are available at the website rachelcorrie.com. RachelCorrie.com. We hear more details on the case from the Center for Constitutional Rights staff attorney Maria Lahoud. Maria specializes in international human rights litigation, seeking to hold government officials and corporations accountable for torture, extrajudicial killings, and war crimes abroad. Welcome, Maria Lahoud, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
Well, we've had you on before to discuss the lawsuit that Rachel Corrie's family and the Center for Constitutional Rights brought against the State of Israel for her unlawful killing. What's happening with the case right now?
Well, CCR represented the Corrie's in the United States in a case against Caterpillar because it was a Caterpillar bulldozer that crushed Rachel to death. The same month, in March of 2005, the Corrie's also brought a suit against Israel in Israel for her killing. That was actually upon the advice of the State Department, because the State Department acknowledged that the investigations done by Israel hadn't been credible, thorough, or transparent, which at the time Sharon had promised to Bush. And it didn't happen. So they said, you should sue them in Israel. So that case began last week.
And is the center involved in that case?
No, just to the extent that we, still...
How do you sue in Israel? I mean, I know how we bring civil cases here. We would bring civil cases against the individuals who were involved in the crime or in the murder, in the killing. Do you sue Israel or do you sue the bulldozer driver?
This is actually a suit against Israel.
And you're allowed to do that,
yes,
together in Israel?
Well, Israel claims, of course, that they have immunity under the same doctrines, really, that the state...
Oh, they do.
Would use here. They claim that, it was an act of war, so they shouldn't be liable, that it was an act of state. They've used some of the same secrecy methods to withhold evidence and not give it to the Corrie's. And they haven't actually presented any of their affidavits yet. They did a motion to the court to withhold doing that until 30 days after the Corrie's present their case. So we won't actually know what their case is for a while.
So the Corrie's are beginning the case.
Yes, they've begun the case.
And they're going to put various witnesses on.
Right. There are four eyewitnesses who are actually at the scene who will say, and photos prove, Rachel was wearing a bright orange vest. It was clear that the bulldozer driver could see her.
Oh, they're saying the bulldozer driver didn't see her.
Yeah, that's what, Israel's investigations found, basically, that the bulldozer driver couldn't see her. So there wasn't even negligence. There's also an expert witness who will testify on behalf of the Corrie's who says that even according to Israel's own policy manuals, they shouldn't be operating heavy equipment like that where people are around. And clearly, they had, the eyewitnesses will say they were waving their arms at the bulldozer driver. They had been in similar circumstances even earlier that day and previously where a bulldozer driver would pull up near one of the human rights defenders and stop, And in this case, that didn't happen. Rachel was standing in front of the Nasrallah home. This was the home of a family she had stayed with before. The family and the children were inside. Rachel was defending the home, and the bulldozer driver just crushed her.
This was in Gaza, right?
This was in Gaza, in Rafah, along the southern border of Gaza.
Is there support over there for Rachel's case?
I think it's probably the same, I guess here. I mean, I think there is a lot of support, certainly among Palestinians. There was a Haaretz article that certainly wasn't bad. I think the Corrie's have done such a tremendous job of really linking, the accountability in Rachel's case to the human rights of Palestinians that Rachel was defending and trying to raise awareness of how, the Corrie's have this opportunity to go into an Israeli court. It's an opportunity that Palestinians really don't have. And even expanding that to, the siege on Gaza right now and the blockade and trying to get that lifted and really calling on our government, the U.S. government, to do what it can. It needs to put more pressure on Israel in Rachel's case and the blockade and with Palestine in general.
Can you go over the sequence for a minute? She was Who was Rachel working with?
Rachel was with the International Solidarity Movement.
And she was there to stop house demolitions, is that right?
Well, you know, she was doing various things. You know, she would walk children to school. I mean, she was defending human rights. And she was, the ISM is a Palestinian-led, nonviolent resistance movement to the occupation. And so one of the things she would do was, when there were going to be house demolitions, they would try to protect the homes. And, you know, this was along the southern border where they were building a wall and they wanted a buffer zone. You know, Israel at times has claimed that, you know, they were demolishing homes of terrorists or, you know, where there were tunnels. But that was clearly not the case in this instance. They didn't end up demolishing the home until 6 months later. And there was no, you know, the eyewitnesses will testify that there was nothing happening in the area.
Speaking about the eyewitnesses, I understand that four of them were granted visas to testify. What countries are they from?
Three of them are Americans and one of them is British. And my understanding is that it wasn't until the U.S. put pressure on Israel that they actually granted them visas. There's also the Palestinian doctor in Gaza who treated Rachel and then who confirmed her death is not being allowed by Israel to enter the country to testify. And they've opposed him testifying even by video conference.
Even by video conference?
Yeah.
Wow. So what do you think is going to happen on that?
Well, I mean, hopefully he'll, I mean, I hope there will be more U.S. diplomatic pressure, and it seems, you know, of course he should be allowed to testify.
Let me see if I understand how this works. The Corys will have presented their evidence, and then there's a break in the trial?
Then there's a break. The Israeli government will have 30 days to get its affidavits together, and then at some point after that will present its case. And this is, you know, this isn't a jury trial. It's just before a judge, so.
What are the Corys asking for?
What they've been asking for 7 years, which is information. You know, they've been just wanting to know more about Rachel's death. I mean, and what happened and try to prevent it. You know, as is in the United States, the way you do that through a civil case is through asking for compensation. You know, they would also like accountability. I mean, it's interesting because, you know, there were three British human rights defenders who were shot in Palestine, and the British government conducted inquests and found that they were intentionally or unlawfully killed. And two of those cases resulted in compensation to the families. And one, you know, the soldier who shot him had a sentence of 8 years. So there has been some accountability when pressed by the British government. And here, there's been no accountability and clearly not enough pressure, I don't think, from the U.S. government.
Now, are there still house demolitions going on in Israel?
Absolutely. Palestine? Absolutely. In the latest, even in the attacks on Gaza from over a year ago, I think over 4,000 houses were demolished. And of course, because of the siege, they can't rebuild. You know, they not only don't have access to food, they don't have their homes.
Where are they living?
In with others or in fabricated housing or, you know, I don't know. I haven't actually had an opportunity to go there recently.
Has anyone else been killed during the demolitions? Residents,
you know, in the case that CCR brought against Caterpillar, we not only represented the Corys, we represented four Palestinian families. There was one family in Nablus, you know, a couple and their a pregnant wife and their three children and their aunts who were in their home in the middle of the night, and their home was demolished on top of them, and they were all killed. There are, you know, we represented others, a man with disabilities and an older man who couldn't get out of their houses in time, and so they were killed when their houses were demolished.
So there isn't really warning in a lot of these
cases? No, not in a lot of them. In some there are, you know, and then people don't even have time to grab their belongings. They just, you know, are able to save themselves. But in several cases, people have been killed or injured.
Gives me shivers to hear this. I mean, what an absolute crime against humanity.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm going to go back into Gaza for a second. Rachel's parents have played an extraordinary role. I mean, I know you know them. They're remarkable, both the way they link what happened to Rachel to Palestinians and how Palestinians are getting killed and they can't get access to court. But there's also been some amazing memorials around Rachel in Gaza. I think there's a soccer tournament of some sort. Is that right? There's something.
Have you seen that there? I don't know.
No.
I think that, I mean, I know that, you know, in when I've been in Gaza, you know, I mean, she is considered somewhat of a hero. I mean, just to have solidarity from an American and to have someone who stood up for them and who was, like so many Palestinians, was killed in their efforts, it means a lot to them.
And then there's also, I think, I was in East Jerusalem, and there's a monument to her in East Jerusalem, a big mural on a wall with a bulldozer.
Yeah.
So she's remembered as quite a hero for what she did.
Yeah, as she should be.
Maria, I think on a BBC documentary, there was some video evidence of part of the occurrence. Is any of that admissible in court?
Well, there was, you know, there are a few things. There was a videotape that was being recorded from the border of the incident. But, you know, the segment from where Rachel was actually crushed and killed is missing. You know, I'm not sure if it actually happened to pan away at that time or if it's since disappeared. But it's, you know, it wasn't until, I mean, the Corys had originally seen, you know, a black and white version and then later saw the color version, which clearly shows Rachel in her bright orange vest. But there will be, I mean, much evidence presented to show that Rachel could have clearly been seen.
And how long do you expect the testimony to go on for?
Well, the testimony right now is scheduled through the 24th of March for the Corey's case. And then, you know, when the government presents its case, I'm not sure how many days they'll take.
And this is in the district court.
You know, it's the Haifa District Court. It's the court of first instance, although it's more akin to our appellate court because it's right below the Supreme Court. But it's a trial court.
So we'll keep bringing you updates around Rachel Corey's case. And I want to talk a little bit with Maria about some of the other cases. Maria is the lead counsel at the Center for a number of cases concerning Palestinians. And one of the most recent ones you filed at the United Nations was the Mamilla Cemetery case. And, of course, we've mentioned that before on our program. But that's about a cemetery. Why don't you just describe it and then tell us where that stands right now?
Well, you know, CCR has been working with descendants whose ancestors are buried in West Jerusalem in Mamilla Cemetery. And the cemetery dates back to at least the 12th century. The Simon Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles is building a so-called Museum of Tolerance on top of this Muslim cemetery. There had been cases brought in Israel trying to stop it, and those were not effective. The High Court said that the building could go forward. So we were contacted by descendants who wanted to stop it and make sure, you know, first of all, they've heard that their ancestors' bodies have been removed. They have no idea where they've been removed to, and they want to protect and preserve the cemetery. So we brought petitions before the United Nations to, you know, essentially because the descendants' human rights are being violated, their human rights to preserve their culture, their human rights to be free of discrimination, and for religious belief. So we've asked the special rapporteurs of the United Nations to intervene and pressure Israel to stop the building. There's also a petition going around both to Israel and the Simon Wiesenthal Center to stop construction of the museum, to, you know, locate the remains and rebury them in accordance with the Muslim authorities, and to preserve the rest of the cemetery as well.
It does seem intentionally provocative. I mean, to be first doing this on a Muslim cemetery and secondly to be doing it as a Simon Wiesenthal, Center for Tolerance. And so where can people go if they want to learn more about it and sign the petition?
There's, you know, you can come to CCR's website for more information and search Mamilla.
M-I-L-L-A.
And you can also go to the Mamilla campaign. Just www.mamillacampaign.org and find out more.
I just want to put this into a bit of context. Various documents leading up to the establishment of the State of Israel all address this issue of the obligation of Israel and the Palestinians mm-hmm. to preserve historical and archaeological monuments. It's everybody right. acknowledges that. Right. It's an absolute obligation.
Yeah.
And I know in the petition you mentioned that up to at least 2007, Israel had agreed to make historical monuments or preserve yeah. historical monuments of 130 some up to 2007. And the question I have is, were any of those Muslim or Christian?
No, every single one of them was a Jewish holy site. And this is despite even the Israeli government, you know, since the 40s saying it would preserve this historic Muslim site. And it's not doing that. It's instead permitting the Simon Wiesenthal Center to build a museum of intolerance, essentially.
Right, on top. And recently, actually, we heard about two more historical sites that Israel is now claiming as historical sites, mm-hmm. and those are, if you recall? One is the one in Hebron, the cave where Abraham's wife, Machpelah, Sarah, was supposedly buried, which I actually visited a few months ago. It's actually the place where 29 Palestinians were murdered by an Israeli settler.
Right.
And the other one is the place where Ruth was buried, I think, the biblical Ruth, in Bethlehem, I think.
Yeah.
And so that adds to the list. So every month they're increasing the number of Jewish historical sites while essentially demolishing Muslim sites.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think this is just indicative of erasing Palestinian culture and trying to displace Palestinians from the land that, that's
theirs. Right. It's pushing them out first
and
then pushing out their historical memory as well. And Mamilla Cemetery fits that just perfectly.
We look forward to having you back for further updates.
Yes, thank you. Thanks for having me on. Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Kennedy's been dead now for 47 years. Today, we speak with James W. Douglas, the author of JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. The essence of this extraordinarily well-researched and documented book, I would say the best book on this topic, is that Kennedy had changed his mind about being a cold warrior, was trying to turn things around, and that it was elements in the CIA and the military establishment that had him assassinated. We're delighted to have with us longtime peace activist, author, Catholic theologian, James W. Douglas. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael.
Jim, in contrast to, say, Cheney, who said with respect to the Vietnam War when he dodged it that he had better things to do, or Bush, who played hooky from the Air National Guard when his dad got him into that. John F. Kennedy was in World War II. He knew what war was about. He was a real war hero, actually. And your book starts out talking about his experiences in World War II. Talk to us about that.
I think that those experiences are, as you've already indicated, Michael, a foundation for his presidency. He was in the South Pacific. Of course, he volunteered, and he wanted to go into the war. He wanted to accept responsibility for the fighting. And he was, as everybody knows, sort of on his PT boat. But what happened on that PT boat when it got split into two one midnight by a Japanese destroyer is the real story. And he lost brothers. He lost people he loved at that time. And he also had this extraordinary experience when he was saving other people's lives of being adrift overnight, really, in the midst of the ocean, trying to alert other PT boats to the problems of his brothers. And during that experience, he both drew a deep distrust of military authority because he saw what they did not do and what they did do. in negative ways in the war. And secondly, he basically, I think, was given a mission during that time of trying to end war. And he had the opportunity when he became president of the United States.
That's really the heart of this book. Why did Kennedy die?
Yes.
And if you understand that, you understand the forces behind his assassination.
Yes, yes.
And that's what we'd like to talk to you about. Let's talk about how it all unfolded. He got into office, and right away he was faced with the Bay of Pigs invasion.
Yes.
And what was his conclusion with respect to the CIA when he got involved in that situation?
Well, he said very specifically, I want to splinter the CIA in 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds. He felt that he had been lied to, manipulated, and set up, I should underline, by the CIA. They knew that what they were telling him was false, that there was going to be an internal revolution when the exiles landed. They knew that wasn't going to happen. They even had the terrain messed up in his mind. They thought they could convince him that the exiles could go into the kind of terrain where they could hold out on the edge of Cuba. All of this was false. And the point was to put him in a position where he would have to call in U.S. troops in order not to take a loss as a young president. And they thought inconceivable that he would. Well, they were wrong. As Kennedy said to his friends, they had me figured all wrong. And he took the loss rather than do what he said he would never do, which was send in U.S. troops. He would no more send in U.S. troops in Cuba than he would in Vietnam. He always drew the line at that. I will not send in U.S. combat troops. He wouldn't do it in Cuba. He wouldn't do it in Vietnam.
Jim, can you talk a bit about what you call Kennedy's vision and also explain what you mean in the title by the unspeakable?
Well, to begin with the unspeakable, because that's sort of the backdrop of the book, that comes from Thomas Merton, a monk, spiritual writer, and a friend also, who wrote a book called Raids on the Unspeakable. And he meant by the unspeakable the kind of evil whose depth and deceit seems to go beyond the capacity of words to describe. And it was in the midst of the Vietnam War, the nuclear arms race, and the assassinations of the Kennedys and Malcolm X and Martin Luther King that he used that term. Kennedy's vision is articulated especially in the American University Address, June 10, 1963, which arose out of his turnaround from the missile crisis and from these experiences that we've already been going into, the Vietnam War and back at the Bay of Pigs. In the American University Address, he says that he wants to end the Cold War. That could be the basic summary of the whole thing, but he wants to do more than that. He wants to begin not only envisioning, but moving step by step into a disarmed world. And he wants to do that concretely with a guy named Nikita Khrushchev, his enemy. And Khrushchev read that speech, heard that speech. In fact, he put it all over the Soviet Union and all their radio and TV networks. And he said, this is the greatest speech a U.S. president has given to Roosevelt.
It absolutely was, and you reprint the entire speech in JFK and the Unspeakable,
yes.
Why he died and why it matters. We're speaking with James W. Douglas about this really extraordinarily important book. Jim, talk to us about Kennedy's second experience in Cuba with the Cuban Missile Crisis, and then let's talk about the back channel he opened up with Nikita Khrushchev afterwards.
Well, the Cuban Missile Crisis is a deeply misunderstood part of our history because it's usually presented as Kennedy going to war with Khrushchev and winning, beating him, sort of 12 noon at the OK Corral and all that kind of stuff. That's really the opposite of the story. What really happened is that both Kennedy and Khrushchev realized they were in over their heads, and Kennedy especially, because his military people were pushing for a nuclear war. They wanted a nuclear war because the U.S. had far more missiles and warheads than the Soviet Union. The generals felt they could win. This is insanity, and that's what it was. And they pushed by sending missiles, even test-firing missiles in the midst of the missile crisis to try to get the Soviets to move in such a way that they could justify a preemptive attack on the Soviet Union. Well, Kennedy realized all this kind of incredible stuff was happening, and he appealed secretly to Khrushchev to help him get out of that mess that they had both gotten into. And when Khrushchev got this secret appeal that went through Robert Kennedy and the ambassador to the Soviet Union, Anatoly Dobrynin, and of course RFK was the attorney general at the time, Khrushchev got this appeal and he said to his foreign minister, we have to let Kennedy know that we want to help him. And he almost couldn't believe what he was saying because, of course, that was his arch enemy. But he said, yes, we now have a common enemy to save the world from those pushing us toward war. And at that point, the whole thing, the whole Cold War turned upside down because Khrushchev and Kennedy became closer to each other than either was to his own military and industrial power system. That was a truly amazing point in all of our history.
Very few knew of this secret relationship.
That's true. And it had been going on. It didn't just happen in the middle of the missile crisis. The irony was that these two were struggling in a relentless way over the Cold War and very publicly, and at the same time, secretly, they had this correspondence going on where they were trying to get out of it. And they had the sense, both of them, to realize that they were engaged in a titanic battle that could destroy the whole world, and they kept under the radar of their own systems by this secret correspondence. And we have that all available to us today, but historians ignore it because it doesn't fit with the public image.
That's why your book is a hidden history that's immaculately documented. It's an extremely important book. I urge all of our readers to get it. JFK and the Unspeakable by James W. Douglas. Let's talk a second about what happened, the missile crisis, and then with Vietnam, because I had thought about the missile crisis just the way you laid it out. And then I also thought about Vietnam, that Kennedy had no intention of backing out of Vietnam, that he was steadily getting the United States involved. My whole preconception of Kennedy as a cold warrior was turned around by the documentation in your book, JFK and the Unspeakable. So talk for a moment, would you, about his notion about what the United States should do with respect to Vietnam and the national liberation movement that was going on there.
Well, I should say, too, Michael, I got turned around. I was very skeptical of Kennedy when he was alive, and I didn't understand any of this stuff when it was going on, and I didn't catch up to it for 30 years. So I've got that in common with everybody else. But anyhow, on Vietnam, Kennedy was drawn into it, and he didn't want to get involved in Vietnam. He made a very strong stand against involvement in Laos, and that typified his early resistance to his advisors after the Bay of Pigs. He negotiated a peace in Laos that involved negotiating with the communists in a coalition government. And so all his national security advisors were appalled by that. So they pushed for his involvement in Vietnam, and he conceded. He gave advisors to the state that had been set up with Diem, South Vietnam. It's a state that was basically U.S. created because we refused to allow the elections. Eisenhower refused to allow the elections that would have kept Vietnam as a single power and under Ho Chi Minh, who would have won the election easily. But anyhow, Kennedy, that's all prior to Kennedy, and Kennedy was going along with this to some degree because he couldn't beat his national security advisors everywhere, so he conceded advisors, but he wanted an exit policy, and his military people would not give him an exit policy. For a couple of years, he was insisting, saying, give me an exit policy. I want out of here, and I want you to tell me, I want you to set it up so we can get out of here. So finally, in 63, McNamara simply ordered it, McNamara being Kennedy's defense secretary, who was helping him, who tried to resist to some degree the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And then Kennedy pushed through a national security memorandum, NSAM 263, which ended the Vietnam War by an order in terms of everybody out by 65 and 1,000 U.S. troops out by the end of 63. And none of that happened because that October NSAM 263 was voided very quietly as soon as Kennedy was killed in November. So he actually signed the withdrawal order from Vietnam before he was assassinated. And Lyndon Johnson turned it around 2 days after his assassination when he met with Henry Cabot Lodge, who was the man in charge down there and out there in Vietnam. And Kennedy was about to fire him, and Lodge said, I'm not going to be the one who surrenders in Southeast Asia.
Jim, talking about the assassination, you
yes.
say that Kennedy knew
yes.
that he was going to die, and yet still had the fortitude, the moral fortitude, to stand up to the system. Talk a little bit about that.
He had this, what friends who were critical of it would call his obsession with death. It wasn't an obsession with death. It was a very realistic assessment that he was going to die, because if you walk a certain road, if you try to turn around a national security state that is dominating the world, most powerful force in the history of the world, and you try to do so as president of the United States, well, of course you're going to die. Either that, you're going to be thrown out of office by some kind of subversion process, some kind of a coup. And so Kennedy knew that. Now, Kennedy also had a certain awareness of death because of his experience in World War II, so I don't want to minimize that. But he had a very realistic assessment, and he knew when he was going to Dallas that this was probably it, and he was saying goodbye to people before he left, including especially his father and his dead son, whom he visited at his grave site. He did these things just a month before his assassination, And he also, there's an incredible scene that I described in the book where Caroline, his daughter, recites a poem to him in the midst of the National Security Council, "I Have a Rendezvous with Death." It's the most incredible moment. And at that moment, Kennedy was both communing with his daughter over his anticipation of his death, and saying, okay, if I have to, I have to, but I'm going to do this thing.
James W. Douglas is the author of JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters, a very, very important book. Jim, let's talk about history and turning points in history.
Yes.
And put this book in perspective. Had Kennedy not been killed, there would have been no massive loss of Vietnamese and American lives in Vietnam.
That's true.
Had he not been killed, there wouldn't have been a massive loss of lives of people in Indonesia.
That's true.
Because he was reaching out to Sukarno.
That's right.
Had he not been killed, there would have been nuclear disarmament.
That's true.
And it seems that, you know, history is not just this inexorable force, that at certain moments people can make their own history, you know, within certain limits, but can make their own history. And Kennedy was trying to do that. And that's what's so extraordinarily moving and sad and really shakes you up about coming to these realizations when you read your book.
Can I add one more, Michael?
Yeah.
Fidel Castro.
A very
critical player in this whole history.
I'm sorry that I forgot to ask you about that.
We wanted to ask about his relationship, too.
Yeah, Fidel Castro and JFK were getting together. That's the underline it, circle it. JFK and Fidel Castro were getting together. There is no question of that. It isn't even a maybe they were. They were definitely, and there were secret negotiations going on between them through intermediaries at the very moment that Kennedy was being killed. He had a guy named Jean Daniel, a very good French reporter, who was talking with Castro at the very moment that Kennedy was assassinated. And they had been together for 6 hours going over JFK's questions for Castro in a hotel a couple of days before, and they were having lunch together, Jean Daniel and Fidel, at the moment that JFK was killed. And when Fidel got the phone message and then the confirmation that JFK had died, he just said, everything has changed, everything is going to change. And that is the truth. And to that, from that day to this, we still have not normalized relations with Cuba, which would have happened in, probably 64 to 65 if JFK had lived.
You also spoke about the murders of Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, and Bobby Kennedy. And I understand you're going to be writing books on these.
That's true. It's all one story. The death of those four by the same forces in a period of 4.5 years from late 63 through mid 68, that's a story of the 60s. It's a story of the destruction, the deliberate destruction of hope, not much more so than any individual characters like the Kennedys or Malcolm X or MLK. It's the destruction of hope. It's the destruction of a vision of change. It's the destruction of a turning in this country and in the world, all of which was happening and had to be stopped by the forces that were behind, well, that's what Merton sums up as the unspeakable, the forces that were behind the Vietnam War, the nuclear arms race, and those assassinations.
I truly believe that.
It has been documented in various ways by various people, but it has to be put together. It's our story. It's our story.
Jim, I have to ask, how did you become interested in this topic and start doing your research on it?
Very specifically from Martin Luther King, not John Kennedy, but from Martin Luther King. When he was assassinated on April 4, 68, I was a professor in the religion department at the University of Hawaii, Honolulu Manoa campus, and in our class, which was on the theology of peace, there were young men who, inspired by King giving his life, and they, as they understood it, and rightly so, to stop the Vietnam War, they didn't think it was James Earl Ray as any lone assassin that killed Martin Luther King. They understood it was deeper than that, and they thought it meant killing him, especially because he's trying to end the war and because he was trying to end poverty through the Poor People's Campaign. And so what they did, without my knowledge, was they had a little gathering and they burned their draft cards, which meant some of them went to jail for 6 months, some for 2 years. I joined their group. We called it the Hawaii Resistance, and that was basically the end of my academic career.
That'll do it.
That did it, yeah. Well, I lasted a little while longer, but that was basically the end. And that meant I wanted to understand. That was my baptism into nonviolence, not as an academic topic for seminars, but as a way of life. And so now I'm a Catholic worker. We have a Catholic worker house, and we go to Iraq when we can. We do what we can, as you do, for real law, not disorder.
So, well, we're laboring in the same vineyards,
Douglas. So that changed my life. So ever since then, I've been trying to catch up to King's assassination. And in 99, I went to the only trial ever held for the assassination of Martin Luther King in Memphis. 6 weeks, 70 witnesses, and a verdict in a wrongful death lawsuit initiated by the King family, a verdict of, yes, a conspiracy. This is a jury of 6 black and 6 white jurors. Yes, it was a conspiracy of U.S. government agencies. That's in their verdict. That's in their verdict.
Yeah.
U.S. government agencies killed Dr. Martin Luther King. In the verdict of a wrongful death lawsuit initiated by the King family, and the verdict came down December 8th, 1999. How many people in the United States know about that today?
It's a hidden history, like the assassination investigation by the Congress said that there was another assassin, not just Oswald. So there was a conspiracy there, too. It's a hidden history.
It was King that sent me to Kennedy. It wasn't Kennedy. You know, through King, I could understand because we had the same politics and spirituality. John F. Kennedy, come on, you know. I had no sense that he was subject to the same thing, but he was.
I just urge people to go out and get James W. Douglas's book, JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. This is an Orbis book published in connection with the Marinol Brothers here in New York, very important publishing house, and they've done us a great, great service by publishing this book. James W. Douglas, JFK and the Unspeakable. Jim, do you have any final thoughts you want to share with us?
Yeah, we're in the same scene right now, exactly the same scene. And what we saw going on last fall with Generals Petraeus and McChrystal setting up Obama, it's exactly the same as the Joint Chiefs of Staff setting up and the CIA setting up Kennedy at the Bay of Pigs, McChrystal, Petraeus, they were dictating terms to the president. And unlike Kennedy, he did not face them down. If he does face them down, as I hope he will in the future, he's going to be in the same position Kennedy was. And that's what he needs to be in. That's what we need to be in. We need to be way out ahead of Obama so that he can follow. You know, if the people lead, the the leader will follow. So we need to be out ahead of Obama, not waiting for him to do something. And if we get out ahead of him far enough, he will do something. He's a good person. And at that point, he's going to have to face down those generals, which is what Kennedy did. And we all have to face the music at that point.
Jim, I think that's excellent advice. And on that note, we want to thank you so much for this important contribution to our history, and hope that we have you back on again. JFK and the Unspeakable by James W. Douglas. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jim.
Heidi, thank you, Michael.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
This is Eli Smith from the Dustbusters, and you're listening to Law and Disorder. If you like this kind of old folk music, check out Down Home Radio at downhomeradioshow.com.